Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And you know it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And please try to consider, well, actually, I think everybody is those who have faith and are doing what they need to do or are ardently praying, because I'm not getting the signals and the feelings that we're going to be heading in the right direction. Folks, just because we've got somebody that is going to, have moral controls over our society instead of immoral controls over our society, doesn't make the moral controls right when those powers aren't delegated. So my point is, even though we may be buying into this, at least we don't have, we're not sexually dysphoring our children, we're not doing all of these terrible things to our children and all these other things, but we're still exercising powers that we shouldn't be. And so we've got Tammy with us. And as a matter of fact, I commonly point out that when we look at the many problems that we have, Tammy, mm-hmm. one would think that, how do we even start doing this? How do we let, let's just focus on the children. I could go into marriage and all these other issues, but when we look at the children and the curriculum that they're giving the kids today, they're weaponizing them to basically surrender their liberties and just embrace global communism. They want to get rid of guns. They're programming these children to basically go and complete the insurgency against the Constitution. And so my point is, how did we get here? Because the reality is, when we started doing this education system and this curriculum and national standards and so forth, that was done under the conservative, for the better of the kids. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, we, supposedly, or you, conservatives, opened the door. It's just like socialism was initiated by the greatest generation. Having a parent that was a part of that and held his head high, my father used that as a bragging point until I pointed out and stated the obvious. How is it that you guys are the greatest generation when you're the ones that actually supported the concept of socialism in America by giving yourself Social Security? You went and fought against, some global tyrants, but I think that, the fact that we didn't pick ourselves up by our britches, and pull up our bootstraps, and take on the problems at hand. Instead, we allowed a socialist to inflict socialism upon us. I don't think as many people realize how bad it was during the Depression. And I don't mean the lack of food and everything else, because the conditions were created by government.
Yeah, they created the problem, and then they came out with the socialist solution.
They created the collapse, which led to, and then what they did, instead of allowing the market to correct itself, what they did was they started pouring money and programs in so that people would wait for government's hand, their handouts. Instead of, we got to figure out what to do at each state and let each state start moving on. And when all of a sudden a few states had hope, people would move to that state. And then the other states would say, hey, we got to do this too, so that everybody does their part. And actually, they had, so Hoover was the Secretary of the Treasury at the time of Harding's collapse. Now, I forget what history book I read this in, but this was amazing because Hoover went to Hardy and told Hardy, we need to pump money into the economy so that we can, soften the blow on the people. And Harding looked and goes, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, we got this, you know, this collapse. And he goes, yeah, I know about the collapse, but what are you talking about softening the blow? And he goes, well, this is what we need to do. And he goes, well, let me think about it. And Harding deliberately, you know, waited, you know, didn't do anything. He just ignored it. He just basically placated him and said, let me think about it. You know, give me some time. And about 6 months later, Harding actually looked Hoover up and said, hey, remember that plan you had of throwing money into the economy? Look, the economy's recovered. Isn't that great? And we saved the people money. Mm-hmm. And Harding was a crappy president. He was the one president that admitted he was the worst president of them all. Because he was a philanderer. I mean, he really hardly did anything as a president. And because he was so lazy, the one thing that he actually did right was not do something. And so Hoover, you know, that really stewed at him. And most people think Hoover was a Republican. Hoover was a very close confidant of Wilson. And Hoover was one of the very few people that had the, I'll just say, quote unquote, the authority to write a biography on Wilson's life. That's how close they were. So when we look at Hoover all of a sudden becoming the president because Coolidge didn't want, because he lost his son and he chose not to run again. And so Coolidge basically said, nah, you know, I can't do this right now. So Hoover just do-si-dos right into the White House. And the next thing you know, in that election year of 2028, everything was set up for the collapse of 1929. And so as soon as that collapse occurred, Hoover was there ready because he knew exactly what to do so that he could turn on the printing press and devalue the currency, because that was the point. And basically get people to, just like the pandemic, when everybody just said, oh, well, we're going to get all this assistance. We're going to get this extension of unemployment. And boy, this is going to be good. We're going to kind of be on a vacation. And government's going to pay us. They should never have done any of that. They had no authority to do any of that, even way back then. So my point is that when we look at our government and what it's doing, we don't question why in the heck and how in the heck did they get this to, you know, to be doing these things. And 9 times out of 10, it is by social engineering, because the government has already been able to assume anything that they want, and they've been engineering themselves into actually committing warfare against us and actually polluting us and doing things that it's unfathomable. It's unconscionable. Anyway, we're doing the Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions. We just wrapped up with 22. And this is where Madison basically pointed out that the whole point here of taking the position of interposition, because he's kind of built up to this point. He has basically already said that, you know, we don't want to be hasty in doing this. But when we can actually see that the laws or what the federal government is doing that can hasten us into oblivion, to our destruction, then we have no choice. We have to interpose. And so right here is where Madison basically responds to the very specific charge by the other states regarding the Supreme Court having the responsibility of mediating and arbitrating what needs to be done. Now, as I say, and I've written this and I've said this so many times, that if this was a video show, you'd actually see my face all like indigo. I mean, really a deep blue. Because I say this all the time. Every time you walk into a court that hasn't jurisdiction over the matter that you're walking into court on, and you actually possess the jurisdiction over that, you are surrendering your sovereignty to a government and giving them the sovereignty over this matter that you're walking into and saying, here, now you tell me what I need to do. And literally you're surrendering your sovereignty so that they can take advantage and inflict upon you things that you that would never have happened had you actually asserted your sovereignty. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So let's go ahead and dive into this 23rd paragraph, because it's really one sentence, but it is, you know, it's insightful, because this is where he says, but it is objected. So go ahead.
Okay. But it is objected that the judicial authority is to be regarded as the sole expositor of the Constitution in the last resort, and it may be asked for what reason the declaration by the General Assembly, supposing it to be theoretically true, could be required at the present day and in so solemn a manner.
Okay, so sole expositor is basically the same thing as arbiter or, you know, mediator. And so only they have the ability to oversee this. They are the tribunal that has the jurisdiction. Well, Madison's already stated that they don't. Up in 18, he stated that when there is no court, there's no tribunal that has the authority over these matters, then the parties themselves are the ultimate and final authority. And so he basically lays out that in this last resort, it is being stated that the Supreme Court has to do this. And basically he's saying, how is it that this can even be possibly true? So now he goes on what I would say in 24, he's going to give you a couple of instances or a couple of examples of how they couldn't. And then down in the middle of 24, what he does is he kind of says, okay, you know, those are some, okay, here's some reasons, but the proper reason or the proper answer to the objection is this. And so, you know, and this is interesting the way Madison does this, because instead of just answering the question, he says, well, one could deduce that this is one reason, and one could deduce that this is another reason, but the proper reason is this. So he's really going out of his way to teach this legislative body a better granularity, a better, you know, detail of, you know, why they did what they did. So go ahead and let's pick up with the objection.
Okay. On this objection, it might be observed first that there may be instances of usurped power which the forms of the Constitution would never draw within the control of the judicial department. Secondly,
okay, hold on here. So now okay. he basically says that, like I've been saying, and one would think that this was the argument, on this objection, it might be observed first that there may be instances of usurped power which the forms of the Constitution would never draw within the control of the judicial department. In other words, they wouldn't have jurisdiction. In other words, one would say that, you know, a basic response and an absolute answer is that they just don't have jurisdiction. But that's not the ultimate answer. And then go ahead.
Secondly, that if the decision of the judiciary be raised above the authority of the sovereign parties to the Constitution, the decisions of the other departments not carried by the forms of the Constitution before the judiciary must be equally authoritative and final with the decisions of that department.
Okay, so what he just said is that if we allow to elevate the judiciary over us, over this matter, and grant them the sovereignty over the matter, then it's not only the judiciary that obtains this facade, this false authority. It's all the other branches. The president now can create a branch or create an executive department for the forests, because they came in and they took advantage and said, you have forests, we're taking them. And then the judiciary says, well, we'll allow it. Now the executive can come in and start harvesting that. And now Congress can come in and start creating laws and putting, you know, unconstitutional enforcement agencies in there and so forth. So that's what he's basically saying, that when you elevate one part of the three branches of government, you elevate all of them. Mm-hmm. Now he actually answers. See, this is really insightful because he's giving people a real lesson on the consequences of doing something one way or here's another way. But this, you know, and that would occur in those instances. But here's the real reason. And so go ahead.
But the proper answer to the objection is that the resolution of the General Assembly relates to those great and extraordinary cases in which all the forms of the Constitution may prove ineffectual against infractions dangerous to the essential rights of the parties to it.
Okay. So there it is. He says, but here's the real objection, that the resolution that they created relates to those exigent or those urgent circumstances that are so dangerous that the essential rights and the foundation of the union is in peril. And the bottom line, only they have this power to do this. If they allow somebody else to do it for them, the nation is totally at risk of losing the union and everything else. In other words, and, you know, the way he's making it sound is almost as if the doomsday is tomorrow. Madison didn't state that because he knows that it is an incremental process. It's always done incrementally, right? It's like with the camel, you know, getting the nose in the tent and a little bit more and a little bit more. And next thing you know, the camel's in the tent, but it took a while. It didn't just happen in a minute. The camel didn't just knock over the tent. The camel wanted that tent to be there so it could get in and take over it. Because if it knocked it over, then it wouldn't have any protection. So it needed to keep that tent in its position or form and then get you out so there's room for it. So anyway, so go ahead and finish the rest of this part.
Okay. The resolution supposes that dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed by the other departments, but that the judicial department also may exercise or sanction dangerous powers beyond the grant of the Constitution.
So in other words, once they can assume these powers, they may actually use these powers to grant themselves other powers or to justify the granting themselves of other powers. In other words, once you allow this breach to occur, it's like that little child story about the levee. And once you allow a little water, the erosion begins. Mm-hmm. Once you've allowed this breach in the contract, erosion will continue. So he's pointing out that it's not something that's going to actually happen tomorrow, but erosion will occur. Go ahead.
And consequently, that the ultimate right of the parties to the Constitution to judge whether the compact has been dangerously violated must extend to violations by one delegated authority as well as by another, by the judiciary as well as by the executive or the legislature.
And in this particular case, who did the violation? The Alien and Sedition Acts. Who was it? Wasn't the judiciary that created the violation. So 9 times out of 10, the reason why the states would need to step in isn't necessarily because the action came from the judiciary. In those days, it was perceived that the action would be coming from the legislative branch because they're the ones that would actually create the laws, and that's exactly what happened. Nowadays, we actually see, because the federal court has granted themselves unlimited jurisdiction, nowadays they can bring a case in and actually hit us sideways over marriage, over life, over all of these different things, because they now have their hands on every case and they can actually use that to manipulate us over something we didn't even see coming. It didn't come from Congress. It came from the court. It's kind of like also when we, you know, we find that, oh, in some ways it comes from Congress. Like, actually, I'll give you a point in where it came from the president. The Environmental Protection Agency came from Nixon. Nixon basically said, okay, I'm going to give the people this Environmental Protection Agency because DDT is killing the eagles, and that was a bogus lie. But because they actually had all this propaganda teaching people that DDT was this real evil stuff, and, you know, asbestos was, but we didn't see anybody going after asbestos or anything like that. What they did was they tried to create, it was a straw man, but they basically created this boogeyman that we had these environmental problems. Not that we didn't have environmental problems, but Nixon decided to take that on as a national measure. And therefore, he said, I'm creating the Environmental Protection Agency. At that point in time, he had, if I remember correctly, there was a Democratic Congress. And they, oh, yeah, we love this. And they created that. And so he basically says, we're going to do that. And they started normalizing this Environmental Protection Agency. And then they created this bureaucracy. And actually, the Chevron case kind of speaks to how bureaucracies actually started creating their own regulations, coming up with the science and facts and saying, okay, you now can't do this and you can only do this because we've done all this research. In other words, they became a law-making entity.
Yeah, now we're run by bureaucracies instead of law.
Right. Well, technically, that would be an executive form of government because the executive create these bureaucracies to create law.
Right.
Even though he's not the one directly doing it, they are under him. He's the one that actually puts the people in and then drives the agenda. Right? When we had the Environmental Protection Agency under Trump, they were being downscaled, pulling back, and they had leadership that says, we're not getting involved in those things. That changed with Biden, and he weaponized them. And that's how the president now, or an executive form of government, can actually, you know, be unleashed upon the republic and actually attack us and use, unconstitutional measures to go after us. Now, we got 2 minutes left. There's no point in diving into 25. We'll wait until we come back from the break. And technically, we got three more paragraphs. So
what then should have Congress have done?
Congress should have said, no, you with the Environmental Protection Agency, that would require an amendment. And they would not have funded that. And they actually would have gone, they should have gone to the Supreme Court and said, we've got a president that is actually executing powers that he doesn't have. He's legislating something and he has no legislative power. That must come from us. And we're not doing that. And so, because that's why we have separations of powers. But everybody is helping everybody. It's just like, it's a free-for-all. When you get kids, when one kid can figure out how to start creating the rules so they can manipulate the game for themselves, it's bad. And then you really have, you know, an absolute power vested in a single tyrant. And you're basically tied to those whims of the individual. When you actually create a broad spectrum, an oligarchy or a group, and in this case, the federal, the judicial, and the legislative, or I should say the executive, judicial, and legislative bodies are now empowering themselves, they become the tyrant. And it is a shared tyrant. And I tell you what, when people start thinking, they can actually start doing a lot more to you than what one person can think of. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it can go south very fast. And that's one of the reasons why, as they started breaching the contract and the erosion started beginning in the 1800s, it just got a little worse. By the time we hit the 60s, it was completely out of hand. Completely out of hand. So when we come back, we will pick up with the next paragraph. I think it's 26. And so when we come back, we'll hopefully wrap up the last of these paragraphs for the report on the resolution. So we'll be right back after this, folks. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we're jumping into 25. And Madison is going to expound further what the heck is going to happen if we allow the judiciary to basically usurp this authority by using them as the portal of the federal government obtaining control. I guess that probably is the key word here. It is a portal. When one branch can become the portal of assuming some power, whether that's the president, you know, and I'll give you a case in point. In the 1830s, when we had a downturn in the economy, the pastors throughout the South and, you know, in the interior basically came to, because people were hurting. They were in a downturned economy. There was not enough money out there. Nobody could get money, which means that they were really hurting. And so these pastors, because they saw and they were speaking for their flocks, in other words, they became the representatives of the people, and they walked into the White House. And this has happened several times since. I mean, we saw several religious leaders walking into the White House when Obama was president, right? Mm-hmm. And we've seen other religious leaders, I mean, even with Trump. I don't know about Biden, but I do know that we've seen religious leaders go in as they're representing their parishioners. And, you know, as odd as that may seem, what happened was these preachers or these clergy went in to talk to Jackson, President Jackson, and he felt compassion as a king. And he said, okay, yea, verily, I will create some job programs by, you know, giving some highway funding or what have you to go through your states so that we could, you know, get people. Because if you create a highway and you're paying these people to be out there, what happens is that these people, you know, go into these remote areas, because when you're going from one city to the next city, you're actually going through the wilderness. Back in those days, there wasn't a lot of things in between these points. And so as people would travel, there would be the need for support and so forth, you know, feeding these people. And so that brought, they had to have enough money to pay for the work to do all of that, because the government was paying for that. And so it wasn't just paying for the labor of creating the road. It was all the other support that went into that, which actually, you know, was a good funnel or good actually spigot of pouring water into these different states. And in so doing, that was a usurpation of power, because Jackson, knowing that he couldn't do that because he vetoed a bill in 1830 regarding the bonus bill, or a very similar bill for the Cumberland Gap. We have a video on this that Madison, Monroe, and Jackson all vetoed, but I'm saying this, I'm proving that Jackson became the hypocrite, because Jackson wanted to be, you know, the gracious king. I mean, he took a lot of credit that he didn't deserve, like the debt and the bank and so forth. But he actually acted as a king. He wanted to act like he had all that power. So he was really the first president that had very little compunction or very little constraint in how he would use his executive authority. Don't forget, he was the guy that gave us the Trail of Tears. That was an ultimate execution by the executive of a group of people. I mean, thousands of people, I believe at least 1,000 Indians died on that Trail of Tears. Anyway. So the point is that any of the branches can be that portal. It could be the judiciary. It could be the executive. When they start assuming powers that they don't have, then they become that portal that will actually elevate the other branches. Because as he just said, that's what happens. When you actually pour in, the next thing that one thing that this one brought in, the executive or the judiciary, then all the other branches actually gain that because, okay, now that's ours. It's kind of like, you know, sharing the booty of the take. You know, a pirate expression or what have you, when you go and rob. And as a matter of fact, I think that is even a Mohammedan, because I believe even Mohammed referred to, you know, when they went into war and steal money, that's how they kind of got rich, is by conquering people. They would steal that money. And that's exactly what Spain did and Portugal did into the Americas before Britain started actually using commercial endeavors to build up the land. Anyway, the point is that, you know, when somebody brings it in, they get to, everybody equally shares it at the federal level. That makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so 25.
Okay. However,
let me start this off, because one would think that when Madison says, however true, in other words, you know, whatever the case, it'd be more accurate to say whatever the case is, therefore it may be, because he's not saying that it's true or right here. It's just an expression. Go ahead.
Okay. However true, therefore, it may be that the judicial department is, in all questions submitted to it by the forms of the Constitution, to decide in the last resort. This resort must necessarily be deemed the last in relation to the authorities of the other departments of the government.
Right. So that's basically, he's reiterating what we've been talking about, that when this one department brings it in, it equally gets shared with all of them. Right. Must be necessarily be deemed the last in relation to the authorities over the parties of the government. Or did I actually jump ahead of you? No, that's right.
No,
okay, then we're good.
Right.
Okay, so go ahead.
Not in relation to the rights of the parties to the constitutional compact, from which the judicial, as well as the other departments, hold their delegated trusts.
Okay, so bottom line is, he's talking about how this relationship gets moved up, not in relationship of the rights of the parties, but regarding to that constitutional compact, because the rights of the parties are this oversight. But what he says is from the judicial as well as the other departments. Again, he's basically closing this argument that says if you allow one, they all come with it. Go ahead.
Okay. On any other hypothesis, the delegation of judicial power would annul the authority delegating it.
Okay, so what that means is he's basically saying that it takes away the authority of the state. So anyway, let's look at it this way. When a parent allows the child to start, you know, doing things like buying things, then next thing you know, it is basically taking the control over spending and basically putting, you know, they're going crazy spending. Who ends up paying for that?
Yeah.
The child doesn't pay for that. They don't make money per se. They create the money, but they don't make it. We're the ones that actually make it. And in the fact of making money, they tax us for that. And that's how it pays for their spending. So in other words, it's how they bind us. Everything that they begin to do, they actually say, okay, now we're doing this, you need to pay us more. Now we're doing this, you need to pay us more.
And it annuls the authority of the parent, which is the states.
Right. It actually changes the relationship from the states being the sovereigns and the overseers to enslaving the states to the debt they're creating.
Yeah.
Okay, keep going.
And the concurrence of this department with the others in usurped powers might subvert forever and beyond the possible reach of any rightful remedy the very constitution which all were instituted to preserve.
Now, there's no doubt in my mind that when he made that comment, it probably resonated with these members of the legislature. But I believe most everybody in the time said, come on, subvert forever and beyond the possible reach of any rightful remedy. He didn't really, and what I would have loved to have seen him do, you know, hindsight being 2020, I would have loved to have seen Madison include in this the ratcheting concept, the erosion. He doesn't really mention that. I think he does gloss over it, but he doesn't really highlight the importance, because once you've created the breach, it may not be today, but over time, the erosion will occur. It's we've talked about, and I've used the metaphor of a person walking through the snow. And, you know, we're all, you know, working together in a camp, and somebody, you know, every once in a while we have to traverse from the camp out to the river to get some water. And so as we've created this path, somebody coming along from a different camp, you know, adjoined on maybe the same hill or an adjoining hill, and we, you know, our little ridge that comes off the hill, and they come down and they see, hey, look at, there's a path going down to the river. I'm just going to cut a little bit over there, if you see my point. Okay, I'll have to go a little further out of my way, by, you know, 100 feet, but then I have an easy go for the rest of my way down to the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is that, you know, what they're doing is they're just creating this erosion over time, and it makes it easier and easier for others to adjoin and start using that exact same portal, that exact same path that was created by the one.
Mm-hmm.
This is why when they figured out how to use what I referred to, I think, in my first book, is the mystical clauses. The mystical clauses within the Constitution was the General Defense and Welfare Clause, was the Necessary and Proper Clause, the Supremacy Clause, and the Commerce Clause. Those are the four clauses where the Supreme Court found a opening, or they actually redefined, they lied, and they used those in an unconstitutional context as portals to obtaining new power. And I can tell you that it was constant. I mean, the Wicker v. Filbert case was a case where the Supreme Court, well, actually the government, went into a farmer. Now, this is an interesting one. I think it was 1943. Where the farmer was actually growing wheat not to sell. He didn't want to buy wheat anymore. He was a rancher. He had cattle. And he just noticed that the cost of feed was really incredible. And so this is absolutely amazing how creative they get in taking your money. So this farmer decided to grow his own wheat to feed his cattle. So when the tax man came along and noticed the guy that taxed wheat, he goes, hey, this guy is growing wheat and he's not paying his taxes. So they approached the farmer and said, hey, why are you not paying taxes on that wheat? And he goes, well, I'm not selling it. What do you mean you're not selling it? And he goes, I'm growing this to feed my cattle. And that really upset them because now we're not getting money on something you're doing. And you're benefiting from this. So they came back with they went into court. They got the court to rule. They made the argument that because he's growing wheat and taking himself out of the market from producing and selling wheat and buying it out of the market. In other words, he's removing himself from the market. He should still pay the taxes that he's benefited. So he then had to start paying the taxes on that wheat as if he was putting it into the market.
Right.
See how insidious they
like
get.
Like property taxes.
Correct. Right. So anyway, that's how insidious they get. Now, as Madison starts off this next one, let's go ahead with 26.
Okay. The truth declared in the resolution being established, the expediency of making the declaration at the present day may safely be left to the temperate consideration and candid judgment of the American public.
Okay, so all she's basically saying is that we need to basically get this out to the people, because even though the states may not have understood, we do have the ability to appeal to the American public. And that's exactly what they did, by the way. And this is 1800, and him and Jefferson went out and made an appeal to the public to say, look at what they just did. Go ahead.
It will be remembered that a frequent recurrence to the fundamental principles is solemnly enjoined by most of the state constitutions, and particularly by our own, as a necessary safeguard against the danger of degeneracy.
Right, go ahead.
Degeneracy to which republics are liable, as well as other governments, though in a less degree than others.
So, okay, so he's basically saying, you know, in that long sentence, he's basically saying we cannot forget about the factor of erosion, or we can't, you know, think that this is a one-time thing, that they are, because they've broken through, they're going to erode and work and work and do more and more. Now, one would think that that would really be evil, that the people in there, but in a way, as Washington made note in his farewell address, he said, even though the intentions may be noble of why government would actually go beyond their powers and usurp powers and start exercising them, and the people would say, that's great. Look at, they're saving the children. They're helping those poor folks in that hurricane area. They're doing these things they don't have the authority to do. But isn't that great? And as a matter of fact, that has been the progressive argument for the past several decades. We're the richest nation in the world, and we can't even feed our own people. And then, all of a sudden, we're not only feeding our own people, we're actually paying for their abortions. We're actually not only paying for our abortions, we're actually going worldwide and paying and helping other countries institute abortion. And then, you know, the homosexual marriage and the homosexual agenda wasn't just, you know, paying for that. They actually started going abroad and pressuring and paying other nations through Africa and so forth. You need to be tolerant. That's not their job. I mean, it's one thing for people on their own to be tolerant, and it's a good Christian thing to, you know, forgive and try to work with others. But the point is, government doesn't have the job to be doing that kind of engineering. This is social engineering. And I think I just got a shock from Cynthia, because every time I talk about these mores, these moral issues and so forth, my lack of being so poisonous with my, you know, my terms and so forth, I need to be more vicious. So I can't win being behind the microphone, because, you know, people want me to be really soft pedaling, and then other people really want me to be hard pedaling. And so I'm doing everything I can to try to, because it's not about the social issues. It's about government not having the ability to do the social engineering.
Exactly.
You know, they created a, we're supposed to have a free market economy. We don't. We have a mercantile system. Government controls every facet of our markets. The only free market left in America is called the black market.
Yeah.
Now, when we look at the you know, these other issues and so forth, like religion, we're supposed to have a freedom of religion. We now have a state government that is inflicting godlessness upon the people and saying, thou shalt not bring thy God before us.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I just went on a rant and I kind of lost my place here, other than the fact that I think we're at the less degree than others. So he's just, like I said, he's pointing out, you know, how this creep is going to work. And he goes, go ahead.
Okay. And a fair comparison of the political doctrines not unfrequent at the present day with those which characterized the epoch of our revolution and which form the basis of our Republican constitutions will best determine whether the declaratory recurrence here made to those principles ought to be viewed as unreasonable and improper or as a vigilant discharge of an important duty.
Okay, so what he's doing is he's saying, you know, history is going to record whether we're doing what we should have done or, you know, whether we just kind of wasted some time here. And yes, this is one of the most powerful. I use this as a highlight. And it when people read this, they don't realize how important this is. But this goes to how I constantly say that the foundation of our government is the people. And the foundation of government that the people have created across this republic, because we're a hybrid constitutional republic. And therefore, the only government that we the people make is our local government, our county government. And therefore, when we create that government, if we have failed to delegate the specific powers we want them to rule us, then we've opened the door for them to just rule us by their discretion. So our county government, because we do not have constitutions, are out of control. And they're not even our government anymore. They're basically an administrative state for the federal and state government, and they do what they're told. They don't do our bidding. Therefore, because we fail to institute our county government to hold the state government in check, the state government is being corrupted through collusion, hoodwinking, and what have you, from the federal government that they're supposed to hold into check. And these paupers, these hacks, are actually pocketing money. When you look at the money that the congressional legislators are making, they're becoming millionaires and on their way to being billionaires because they make money and because the lobbyists come in and go, here you go, here you go. Every time they vote for a bill that helps them take more from us. Mm-hmm. And we are the ones this is why I say we are subsidizing you and I, the workers, the people that make money. We're subsidizing communism and inflicting all of these terrible things, regardless of the social, you know, engineering, all of these things throughout the world. Where are the problem? We look at China as the enemy. Yeah, they're absolutely an enemy, but we're helping them, and we've been helping them because Nixon put them as the most favorable nation. I mean, doesn't this rub anybody raw that China has become what they are today because of us?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this last sentence is a mouthful. Go ahead and read this. And most you're going to hear this, folks, and go, how's that a mouthful? Go ahead.
The authority of constitutions over governments and of the sovereignty of the people over constitutions are truths which are at all times necessary to be kept in mind, and at no time perhaps more necessary than at present.
Okay, so what he just said is, and this is why he kind of made this comment, that maybe we need to leave this to the American people, because if the state's not going to actually do their job, then we have to make an appeal, because the last resort goes to the people. If the people fail to rise up, if the people fail to do what they need to do, then we get what's coming to us. And so what he's basically saying is the authority of constitutions over governments. In this republic, our constitutions are over, they're not to operate outside of those constitutions, which is why when we really start examining common law, you'll understand that common law doesn't operate within these governments. In other words, the federal government cannot operate common law. They can't give it to you, which is why they set up this rigging system with the Bar Association to take your common law from you. Because all things that are not delegated to the government, they have no jurisdiction over, leaving to the people their own court system. They declared common law and left that to the people. This is why the state never had criminal jurisdiction. This is why the state, they didn't think about giving that because that was a local issue. They used common law courts at that point in time. But they didn't see, we didn't see them coming as they started pulling in and creating these big civil courts and these unconstitutional courts of jurisdiction that the state wasn't supposed to have. So when we look at the authority of constitutions over government, we allow them to operate outside those constitutions. They create this pretend government. But the fact is, folks, the sovereignty of the people over constitutions is that's the secret that you have to understand or you have to learn. This is the one, you know, the holy grail. We have the power over constitutions. The problem isn't the state constitution. I mean, it's a problem. The federal constitution is not the problem. The state constitution technically isn't the problem. There's some little problems with them. When I say it's the problem, there's some things within it that absolutely need to be changed. Federal constitution is not the problem at all. But the biggest constitutional problem that we have today is that we have never created our county constitutions. And when we create the county constitutions, then we will make a better state constitution that serves we the people. We are the fountain of political power, not D.C. But they've assumed all power and they are reigning on us. We either turn this boat around or you better run for cover. And I don't know where you can go in the world, because when America falls, so goes the world, because we've had that. We've been the puppet of the globalists for over two centuries. That's when it all started. It all started with that national bank. There's no doubt in my mind. That was the little finger that they got under this little sheet to make this nice little, you know, skit. And over time, they have created this whole fake life. This it's not a house of cards. It is a megapolis of cards. Anyway, so does that make sense, what he said here, how the constitutions control the government and how the people control the constitutions? That is probably the most important lesson. Now, we're out of time, so we're actually going to be diving into 27 in our next episode, folks. So thank you so much for joining us, Tammy. And I'm hoping everybody is starting to understand the magnitude of why interposition, and it starts with petitions. We'll get into that, but it starts with petitions. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.